Welcome back, pod people. My guests today are Zach and Jimmy, a co-writing, co-producing, and one of them's a director, filmmaking pair who just made the low-budget sort of slasher, sort of, we'll get into the genre a bit, horror film Followers, which is streaming now exclusively on Screambox. It premiered on March 12th, so just a few days ago. So you should go out and watch that right now, because this is going to be a spoiler-filled podcast. So if you don't want to know the twists and turns of the plot, I recommend pausing this and going and watching Followers exclusively on Screambox. Zach and Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So, speaking of genre, as I just mentioned, one of the things that kept throwing me for a loop in a pleasant way as I was watching Followers is the genre seemed to sort of keep changing. Like, it opens basically in media res in something that makes me think, oh, okay, it's, you know, it's people in the wilderness, they're gonna get hunted, it'll be that sort of slasher film. But then that only takes maybe 20 minutes or something out of the first part of the film, and then it turns into one of those sort of exploration of grief horror films where you see the impact that experience had on these different characters, where like one of them tries to exploit it financially, one of them is just trying to, you know, get through her days without having a bunch of PTSD flashbacks. And then it continues that way for a good chunk of the film, and then it turns into a home invasion movie. And the final act is yet again a different style. So, as co-writers, tell me a bit about how you came up with that structure for the screenplay.
I guess what I would say is, to go back to the question of genre, I mean, it definitely, I viewed it as sort of a classical slasher film, but it was also, I wanted to explore more modern ideas of, you know, I guess mass violence as we know it, and also voyeurism and ideas of misogyny. And so we were trying to kind of create this pastiche of sort of these images and these ideas that we recognize from sort of a traditional slasher structure. In terms of the actual breakup, so the film was shot in two separate parts. The first part was able to impress our lead investor, who gave us the money for the sequence at the house, which I was actually very happy with the way that we were able to all kind of tie it together, because the course of filming everything was a very long journey from kind of this, you know, very small independent film shot in the woods to this kind of gigantic thing that it became over the course of years. And
so sorry, did you say that the final part in the house was shot first?
No, the second. First part in the woods was shot first.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes more sense. Cool. So talk a bit about that journey. So it sounds like it sort of grew in scope and complexity as it went on, and as you got this relationship with the financier.
Yes, definitely. It started as kind of this project during the beginning of COVID, just when we all kind of were laid off and we all were in lockdown. We had this idea to sort of go out into the woods and make this film, and it was just kind of this crazy thing with whatever money we could get. I mean, I put in a lot of my own money, and I was able to get kind of family and friends to invest money, and it became this very small kind of intimate thing, and that managed to kind of impress our lead investor to invest in what was at first perceived as a sequel, like it's about these girls, you know, years later, but then when it was finished, we just kind of decided to just compact it all together, because it sort of made more sense as a flowing narrative about trauma, as you said, and about surviving and kind of living with that, which was a theme that I thought would be interesting to explore with this genre.
Cool. Yeah. So, I could definitely see this being like any given part of this movie being a short film in its own right. But then putting them all together into a single thing, I thought that worked well. I thought that it was a fun way to keep the pacing up without making things feel too frantic.
It kind of needed, like, both parts kind of needed to come together to tell the cohesive narrative. Because without like part one, it was hard to see why these girls are coming together and they've had this past trauma that you haven't really, like, you don't know any context And so it was cool that the two pieces kind of came together and told like a full narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. The girls dealing with the past trauma part reminded me a bit of the book, The Final Girl Support Club, which is exactly what it sounds like. Definitely worth a read if you feel like it. So you said this came together over the course of years.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk a bit about that process. How much of that was pre-production? How much of that was, I assume, what, like 1 or 2 months shooting?
It was, so the first sequence, that was about 10 days, and that was in August of 2020. And like I said, that was kind of it was the middle of COVID. It was, everything was locked down, and it was kind of like there was nothing to do, so we may as well make a film. And then the second part was, I believe, about over 2 weeks. So I would say all told, probably around 25, 30 days. Yeah, in terms of complete filming. But that was about 18 months or so after the first 10 days. Which is kind of cool. It felt like everybody kind of like naturally aged, and kind of, I felt personally older, and everyone felt a little bit more mature about the material.
Yeah, that's an interesting time to be doing that sort of thing. When you said August 2020, my brain went, ah, so last summer.
It was a time warp.
We closed our eyes and it was 4 years ago.
And we very like intentionally wrote the first narrative around the constraints of the time period. Like, so we knew it had to kind of like be all outside, and then kind of bare bones with how many like cast and crew you can have around each other and stuff like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. There are movies that were being made at the time, all of them either seemed to be like that, a small cast and crew filming outdoors, or like a gimmick film shot over a video conference sort of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of great movies in both of those styles.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's an interesting period, because I'd say that I think that COVID forced a lot of people who were on like the bottom of the industry to just very much like, I don't know, it made me feel like this is my time to do something. I mean, if I'm laid off from work, this was years ago, but like I have time to pursue something. I'm going to just throw myself into this project. And it felt like the world was ending, so why not? At least at the time.
Yeah, that's great. So with the amount that the film goes into the different characters and their thoughts and motivations and stuff, one thing that's only sort of tangentially touched upon is the antagonists, who are, from what I can gather, doing some sort of dark web snuff reality show sort of thing, where they hunt people for sport and film it and make money off of this somehow, or live stream it, I suppose. And then their motives become a bit more complicated after their initial hunt is foiled, so that they have this revenge element as well. But all of that I sort of had to piece together from just like things we see. There's never like, we don't really see the audience reacting to the live stream, or like, a cigar smoke filled room with their financiers being angry that their stuff is getting messed up or anything like that. So talk a bit about the decision to not really go into their side of the story.
I suppose it was kind of built around this idea that I didn't want that, antagonists, because the antagonists were kind of built around certain, I guess, hardcore groups that exist on the internet that have very, very negative opinions on people, and feel the need to commit violence. I suppose it would be the most diplomatic way to describe kind of the life inspiration for the villains and whatnot. So I didn't want it to feel like there was almost like a platform for that type of way. That being said, I mean, I do think that it is kind of interesting that it's kind of ethereal and outside, because I would say that once the film was viewed as this giant piece of these two parts, I did kind of realize that was kind of, you do have to sort of piece your mind together what these like villains want, why they're so angry about these people. And I in terms of spoilers, I think finding out that they're kind of just a bunch of misogynists, and they just have these sort of outdated views on people, I think that it makes it almost underwhelming because you think that they'd have a much more intelligent sort of overall plan. But yeah, we definitely tried to give the villains a bit more humor in this one, because in the first time around, in the version that we shot in August of 2020, the villain was just kind of this entity in the woods. And so we tried to give them more like Reservoir Dogs style personalities, like everyone has a different tick or a different thing.
I also think like a big reference was Funny Games. And in that,
I was gonna ask about that.
Yeah. So and in that movie, like the, you know, you don't have a huge context as to who those guys are. They just walk in the house and then chaos ensues. And for me, I felt like that was one of the more terrifying things about the storyline, is that you don't essentially, like, there's not this huge like collective genius behind it. It's just more something that can happen. Which, yeah, I think influenced the plot on ours a lot.
And Funny Games was very banal, which I always appreciated about kind of the violence and the way it's presented. It's very, it's kind of jarring.
Yeah, with one notable exception, I would say, that I would not describe as banal.
Yeah,
in that. Very true. Yeah, okay, so you're both men. What prompted you to make a movie about misogyny?
I think it came from, I've always been like weirdly fascinated with slasher movies, like the classical slasher film, like the original. Yeah, I imagine.
We all are.
It's just such an interesting genre. The fact that it became successful based on very clear ideas and very clear story beats, but it also has been since the 1970s and 1980s accused of misogyny. Which I always thought was kind of interesting, because, you know, I don't think that could be said for some elements of the genre, but then obviously, you know, there are other slasher films that came out that were sort of exploiting that idea. But I just thought it would be interesting to like make a villain that was like the face of that, especially because it's kind of become this thing that's a subculture that's appears to have become more and more popular online, these ideas of, you know, misogyny and Reddit and 4chan and everything. And I just thought it would be kind of interesting to have a villain that literally was the face of that. So it's almost like to accuse it of misogyny would be to accuse it of existence almost. And that at least was my idea in terms of the foundations of the villains.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think that the villains are very clearly misogynists. I also think it would be particularly silly to accuse this movie of it. I was going to say silly to accuse it, but I mean, there are lots of movies that I think would be silly to accuse of misogyny, but people do anyway.
Yeah.
Like the original Halloween, etc.
that's the exact perfect example. Because I don't personally think that film itself is misogynistic. I mean, I think that the character is a murderous, crazy person who kills all sorts of people. And so, you know,
yeah.
One group is interesting, but
yeah. Thinking about really old slasher films, the other one that makes a similar sort of commentary on gender like that comes to mind for me is Peeping Tom.
Oh, yes. Classic.
Yeah. For anyone who hasn't seen Peeping Tom, I mean, first of all, go watch Peeping Tom. It's fantastic. It's arguably the first slasher movie, although really like cat people and the leopard man are,
yeah, like
those are also slashers.
Yeah.
But Peeping Tom is specifically about a man who is a photographer who takes photos of women and murders women with his camera that has like a knife attached to the tripod. And so it's very much about that sort of male gaze and the manner in which it exploits the female body. And this film was shot in a much more traditional manner, whereas like Peeping Tom, you frequently see things from the point of view of the character's handheld camera. Whereas in this, I don't remember a single part where we see things from the point of view of the live stream.
I don't think so either. I think I tried to establish like I always tried to show a character holding a phone rather than showing the phone of itself, just as like a keeping it in grounded in reality type decision, I suppose. But I see what you're saying about that.
Interesting.
That, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that it had me thinking is like, we're very much seeing this from the point of view of the women, the main characters, not from the point of view of the people who are trying to kill them.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Zach actually, so Zach plays one of the villains, and he found out something interesting while we were filming. He found out that his character actually has the most lines of all of the characters as one of the lead villains.
When I was negotiating my salary.
The most lines of any of the characters or of any of the villains?
Isn't it any of the characters, Zach?
Yeah, it was essentially, well, for the followers part. So the part like in the house when the character is introduced.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
But man, sorry, go ahead. That's so surprising. I would have definitely thought it would have been like one of the female leads.
Yeah. But back to your other point too, because it was something we thought a lot about when we were like approaching this genre. And a big thing was kind of deconstructing the slasher narrative and empowering like characters that normally didn't have a lot of power within the trope. So like our female protagonist, Sam, is kind of the strength in the film, and she's able to like rise up and since we're doing spoilers, like defeat the villain, which like the Dylan character within like the narrative of like the Woods story. And so like we didn't want to give a ton of like glory to the male attacker. It was more a character that kind of ended up like being a little bit wimpy and defeated by her.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that it's interesting describing it as a deconstruction there, because I agree that like it starts out as a straight slasher and then sort of deconstructs it by ending like a third of the way in the slasher part ends a third of the way into the movie. But then it sort of reconstructs it at the end with the home invasion part. It reminded me of some other, the name's escaping me at the moment. It'll come to me. But the ending was much more of a downer than I expected. I was all ready for this to be like our main characters win and they kill these assholes, and instead, like, I think one of the villains survives and one of the heroes survives, and that's it. Everybody else dies.
Unless someone pays for a sequel. we definitely, that was before we had a screening for the film about a year ago, and I remember right before, it was the first time we'd ever showed anyone kind of anything, and right before, me and Zach kept going, like, we kept going back and forth, like, are we sure that the ending is like are we sure that that's what we want to do? And it kind of turned into this thing where when we were filming, we had an idea where Sam would clearly survive. She would like run away and it would show her clearly surviving, but then once we showed up the day of, it wouldn't have been framed properly. It kind of would have felt a little bit off. And so my interpretation is always, I've always wanted it to feel like a cliffhanger, like maybe the girls survive. I mean, obviously they're presented as dead, but then Sam's kind of blinking when we see a close up of her. So it's in my head, I would hope that it would be more ambiguous. If it's not ambiguous, then, you know, it's a rough life sometimes, I guess.
she's full on like breathing, trying to catch her breath.
I told her to like give some life, because I wanted the audience to kind of just be, you know, not fully convinced, I guess, that they're dead, or at least that she's dead.
Okay.
That's my hope. If it's not interpreted that way, that's totally fine. I mean, you know.
Yeah, Zach, I think it was also kind of a play on the movie was kind of released in two parts, because we have another film called Follower, and it's essentially like the comprehensive narrative of what happens in the woods. And one of the critical like reviews we got in that one, or like backlash, was that none of the girls died. And so for me, when we were doing it, it was kind of like a play on that, like, oh, this is what you want. Like, night, here it is. You know, like they kind of an in your face, like they all brutally appear to die in the end. So, just to have a totally like polarity.
So is Follower already been made, and has that been already released? Is that available anywhere?
Yes, it's on two. It's essentially, it's a little bit complicated. We shot Follower, which is it's essentially a 60-minute version of the first 15 minutes of this film. That was kind of like a proof of concept that allowed us to get the money for the sequel. And then that ended up being released, but it's released on Tubi. This film is more of like, I would consider this the true proper film, and then that was kind of like the prequel. But it's available on Tubi. It's free to watch for anyone.
And that's the 1 hour and 2 minute long 2022 film.
Yes.
Okay, because there's
a lot of followers.
There's a lot of fun movies with followers. Yeah.
There's many.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of Tubi and distribution in general, Followers is a Screambox exclusive. So tell us a bit about that. How did that come about?
So we premiered the film at the Chattanooga Film Festival, which is a really awesome horror festival. And from there, we got in contact with Cineverse, who's the parent company of Screambox. And just kind of worked out that they, you know, kind of put out everything we wanted to go with in terms of like a distributor.
Cool. So they you said we got into contact with. Did they reach out to you, or did you reach out to them?
They reached out to us on this one. It's like through the festival. That helps a lot, kind of playing at a festival like that, because it's showcasing your film, and that's where they go to watch them, you know.
Interesting. Okay, so the Screambox, there were people who worked for Screambox there, and they had an official relationship with the festival, the Chattanooga mm-hmm. Film Festival. Cool.
Yeah,
quite a coincidence, because I won't name any names yet because it hasn't been finalized, but I'm organizing a film festival this summer called Slime Fest. I think you can probably guess the theme. And a streaming service has reached out to me to do something similar to that with that. So I am glad to hear that this is a successful model that is working for people. That gives me hope.
Right on. Yeah. No, I think it's a great way to, especially at these like genre kind of specific festivals, like showcase your film to the different acquisitions people. And then they get to see kind of like in real time, the audience's reaction before the film's like official release. So it's kind of a win-win for everyone.
Yeah. So would you describe this as a low budget film or a micro budget film? Generally, the people that I talk with, everybody has their own definition, but typically people mean something like $100,000 or less is micro budget, up to maybe $1 million is low budget.
So low budget.
Or low, yeah. Honestly,
yeah.
Okay.
Micro budget. But it was in parts. I mean, we were micro budget for the first the wood sequence, essentially. That was like scrappy, let's go out in the woods, make a film. And then so we got a little bit more money for the later sequences. So I would say low budget, yeah.
Okay. Cool. So tell me a bit about your deal with Screambox. They're right now, they're the only place that anybody can watch this movie. It premiered a few days ago on March 12th. And I say in this sort of strange, detached from time way, because we're recording this a few days before March 12th, and this episode will be live in a week and a half. is that a like exclusive to the United States? Is that a worldwide thing? How are the rights split up?
It's just domestic for right now, and we're exploring international. But the deal with Cineverse is just U.S.
Okay. All right. So does that mean that only American listeners can go and watch this now? And like, if somebody's in France and listening to this, they can't legally stream it?
It's also available. It's TVOD, so transactional video on demand, on iTunes and Amazon as well. And I think a lot of other.
Okay.
What I noticed is releasing our last film is that there were people, they tell us it's North America, but there were people who were able to view it in other territories. I don't know how or where they saw it on. I would assume that it would only be like available in these territories, but maybe people can find it.
Yeah, it's like only officially available in the US.
Okay, so I'm curious about that thing you just mentioned about the there being viewers in other countries where you wouldn't expect it to be distributed. How did you know that those viewers watched it?
Oh, well, with follower one, just looking on Letterboxd and IMDb, just different how people review things or where people were come from. And yeah, I remember after follower came out, there was a review from England. And I wondered how they had watched it or whether they had seen it, but they liked the film, so I was happy about the review.
We also got an extensive review from Indonesia. Wasn't it Indonesia?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. It had like a million views.
Wow. A surge of Indonesian viewers on the film. It was very interesting.
That's cool.
Be really big in Indonesia.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say this is definitely what happened, but I'm gonna guess that those people used VPNs to watch it.
Yeah, I was gonna say VPNs.
We had to guess, yes.
Yeah. But officially, by the book, it's in the US for this release, and then international is to come.
Yes. Excellent. So for all of my Romanian listeners, do the right thing and buy a plane ticket to America so that you can legally watch Followers.
What we expect.
So
you've got Followers on Screenbox and you've got Follower on Tubi. For your next movie, if you could have it distributed in any way that you could choose, how would you choose to distribute it?
Our next goal is for a theatrical release. Is kind of the next stage is our ultimate dream. Mm-hmm.
For Followers or for your next film or
the next film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you interested in a theatrical release because of just, the magic of the Cineplex and the desire to see it on a big screen? So you'd be happy with it showing in a dozen theaters, or do you want like a wide release because that's where the big bucks are?
Well, we did we had a premiere for Followers that played in a legit theater, and
oh, nice.
It was just a super surreal experience getting to watch an audience watch your film. Mm-hmm. With like digital, it's a very like detached experience when it's released because you're not getting to see the people watch it in real time, and there's no. What was really cool with Followers in the theater was it was like this communal experience. Like people were screaming at certain times and angry at the killer at certain times and yelling. And so that was
wonderful.
Really cool to
a very angry to audience.
Yeah.
They were very, I would say that, my goal is to get into a theater. That would be my goal for the next project.
Was the theater premiere the one at the Chattanooga Film Festival, or are you talking about a separate premiere from that?
No, this was just like we rented a theater and had a kind of like friends and family screening when the movie was complete.
Okay, yeah, you four-walled the place.
Yeah.
Chattanooga had actually played virtually, which was really cool because a lot of people across the country were able to see it. So it was cool to get there.
Neat. Yeah,
it's just from all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah, Chattanooga, they had a really cool layout for how they did the virtual premiere. They they had like a Discord server for it, so you can kind of interact with the audience in real time as they were watching it, and they made like a Discord for each of the films, so when people were watching Followers, they could go to like our Follower Discord and talk to us.
The biggest question was this is a spoiler, but the biggest question was if the dummy that fell on the ladder was a real person or not. It was not. We did not throw a production assistant off of a house.
It was half me though. I did split my lip open on that ladder.
It was Zach, but with a wide shot, it was a dummy.
I was the stunt double unofficially.
All right. So that Chat. You said this was you filmed the first portion of it in 2020, and then the rest of it over the 18 months following that. You said.
Yes, it was March of 2022, I believe, was when we shot. That's when everything came together and we were able to get everyone together for the house sequences, basically.
Okay, and then the Chattanooga Film Festival was sometime in 2023?
Yes, it was. I believe that was a year afterwards. So it was. I think it was May 2023. So the film, the edit was finally completed. Got to be February 2023, I believe, around then. because we had the screening itself was January 2023, and that was still kind of a rough cut. So I'd say that the locked cut was a couple months after that.
All right. So you spent like almost a year trying to get it into different festivals, or like talk a bit about your strategy with the festivals, because clearly it eventually worked out for you in like a really positive way. And I've heard a lot of different stories about like people being really successful or really unsuccessful with their festival runs. I'm curious what you guys did.
I think the biggest risk with it is like time. Because it's a really big time gap from when you submit to the festivals and then to when you like actually get in. And we were delaying like going out to distributors until we heard back from festivals. Because if it's this like weird dance, because if you're making like a low budget film that doesn't have any cast that can really sell, then you kind of need a festival pedigree to get to the next range of distribution that's not aggregators specifically. So that was like the real strategy with this film, was like we wanted to get into some sort of prominent film festival to help us at least get into a conversation with a higher range distributor.
Okay. So, and by an aggregator, you mean something like Film Hub?
Or? Yeah. Like, essentially like the different tiers of the distribution world are aggregators, kind of where the companies that just take on like 100 titles and then we'll put them on Amazon and iTunes and so on, and then not really invest any effort into the marketing of the film.
Right.
And so that was really what we wanted to get to the next tier, where we would actually have like a partnership with the distribution company.
Okay. And so then Cineverse is not the distribution company. Cineverse is someone who purchased rights from the distribution company. Is that right?
No, Cineverse is the distributor for Followers.
Oh, okay. They are. All right. Okay. Okay. So was Follower, was that distributed by an aggregator?
Were they? I don't believe that they would identify as an aggregator. They were a lower tier distributor, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Lower tier, meaning like less reach. They don't have their own streaming service, stuff like that, or?
Yeah. And that's not to denigrate them at all. I mean, they did an excellent job, and they did everything that they were contractually obligated to do. We're very excited to be screening Followers with Cineverse.
However. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So the Cineverse contract is just for the United States. How long is it for? Are we talking 6 months, 10 years?
I believe it is a 6-year term.
6 years. Okay. So, so a hefty chunk of the expected lifespan, but not like in perpetuity or whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And, if you would, what fraction roughly of the production cost, is recouped? Like how much are you getting like a big chunk up front and then they just own the rights, or are you getting some sort of like, every time that somebody watches it, you get 5 cents, or?
Yeah, I think expectation wise, if there are filmmakers that watch this year, for the most part, unless you're like winning Sundance or have Brad Pitt in your movie, you're not going to get a big upfront payday from distribution companies, because it's the risk on their end is so high. And
yeah,
like stuff like names, and that's why like actors get paid so much, because it lets them hedge their bets. Like they have domestic value to their names, and there's actually like metrics that they can go and look and like, oh, and you know, like an Austin Butler movie makes this much if it's released in Canada or something. And so without any of those facets, the distribution company doesn't really have anything to go off. So 99% of the time, you're not going to get an upfront payday. It's more just aligning yourself with like a distributor who's really going to like put their muscle behind the film and also be very like transparent with like, you know, they're making payments to you and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So then, you're probably expecting to start getting paid in about 6 months or something like that.
Yeah. Normally the deals are kind of like quarterly payments.
Yeah. Okay. So 3 months.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Awesome. So, talking about the practicalities, the physical task of filmmaking, when you filmed Follower, you filmed Follower first and then Followers, or the other way around?
Follower first and then.
Okay.
And then
all right. So when you filmed Follower, all out in the woods, just a few people, small crew, I assume. And then when you film Followers, you have multiple locations, the budget changes halfway through filming, you have a larger cast and I'm going to guess a larger crew. Talk about like sort of how did those things change and what exactly, like, besides the increasing budget, what exactly motivated those changes?
I mean, a lot of it was necessity. Like you said, sort of the Follower One filming experience for the most part, six people. It was the three girls. It was me. It was our director of photography, Walker Edelman, who was also the DP on Followers. And then it was our sound recordist, Sean Regan. That was the majority of us for 10 days. And then the guy who played Dylan, the villain, he showed up at the end. And that was just like the smallest amount of like, let's go to the woods and make a movie. Just live the smallest amount of people and money I could spend on this production. And then having access to more money in the sequel. One of the things that I really wanted to do was kind of maintain a sense of like cohesion artistically. Like I wanted it to still feel like the same story and same experience. You know, there's a difference. I'd say the biggest difference between the first sequence and the later sequence is the first sequence is set during the summer, while the later sequence is set during the winter. So there's a lot more bundled up characters. But there was a bit of a growth, but at the same time, we were all friends. I mean, I'd kept in contact with the six people that I'd shot the first film with. And so they were all there and we had all formed a bit of a fraternity together, and the new people that showed up, everybody knew each other. And so it was fun because a lot of us were also staying in the big house. So it was just kind of this big filming experience where everybody is involved and they're staying there. And it was like I guess the first experience was like a camping trip, and this was like a
slumber party.
Slumber party, yeah. Right.
A very weird slumber party. Yeah, very weird.
Blood and masks and things, but yeah.
All right. So do you plan on, for your next film, do you plan on continuing with the same sort of general cast and crew, like a John Waters or a Wes Anderson style of filmmaking? Or are you going to, you know, do an open casting call and change things up?
I don't know if I can answer that conclusively at this moment. I mean, there are
fair enough.
You know, Zach and I have been making movies for such a long time that we do kind of have a repertoire of people that I would absolutely love to work with again. I mean, there's no one in either of these films or really on any film I've ever made that I just like would flat out never work with again. I mean, it was a fun experience. I had a good time. It was hard, but it was, if it comes to be, then I will definitely work with all the people that were involved in this project, but also I'm very excited to meet new people if it comes to be for a theatrical film.
Excellent. And the two of you intend to keep working as a pair?
Yes, for now.
Until the glitz and glamour of the Hollywood
life. Until one of us gets offered a bigger check than the other one.
What if I was like, nah, I think it's we're gonna call it in, Zach.
We have no loyalties.
We're gonna finish this interview and then we're done and never gonna talk again.
Our last experience together.
Yeah, it's pretty explosive scream.
I didn't like some of your answers. You talked over me a few times.
All right. So you say you've been making movies for a long time. I wasn't able to find any of them on like Tubi or anything like that.
Insect.
I have a number of short. So we met in college and we made a number of bizarro horror short films, and they're on YouTube in the dark.
Okay.
So I can email them to you if you're inclined to.
Sure, I'll take a look. I watch short films, but I'm not nearly, and I make short films, but I'm not nearly as into short film as a genre or medium or whatever you want to call it as I am feature length films.
Yeah,
Yeah, for a little while, I was interviewing people about short films in this, and then I just put a stop to it because there just isn't enough meat there to really start a good conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think our greatest film education, though, was we did make two feature-length films, like, in our college span, and trying to do that with, like, no budget or cast or crew. I think Jimmy essentially did every single role, and I acted. It was quite the experience.
Hey, I think so. They're hidden right now. Someday we'll make them public to be released to the general population. But
all right, yeah. I'm curious. Like, I would definitely go look those up and check them out if that was an option. But all right. So you want to keep making movies. Do you have a specific next idea, or are you waiting to see what comes to you?
Well, we actually just we're in post-production on a film that we shot this previous fall, which is a totally different genre and different world from Followers and from anything we've previously done. And so we're right in the middle of it, I guess, right now, of trying to lock down a final cut for our film. I would love to make another horror film someday. Maybe come back to the genre, but yeah. What about you, Zach?
Follower 3.
Instead, if the checks come in, we will make Follower 7.
I want to see my character in jail.
Yeah.
Animal masks. Why animal masks?
That's funny. I think it was like, I think I had like a dream of like a wolf mask, because we talked about a slasher movie and we kept going back and forth on what, like, my original idea for what was no masks, just because I thought masks had become cliche and stereotype, which maybe they are. But just the wolf came up as very kind of it's open IP, obviously. and it's also, it's, you know, it symbolizes dogs and men and wolves. There's a wolf mask. I brought my wolf mask here. This is,
oh, great.
It kind of folds in on itself because it's, the material is not the best, but yeah, wolf mask. I wanted it to feel very tribal, I guess would be a way to put it. Cause you know, these masks are based on masks I've seen from societies that have existed for, you know, thousands of years. And so I think that there is kind of a relationship between animal masks specifically and this one specifically, I wanted it to be bright and kind of pop for the audience.
Yeah, this will end up being audio only, so our listeners cannot see that. Oh. This is the one with yellow tufts of hair on the cheeks and top of the head.
I'm like showing it off.
I'm enjoying looking at it.
Verbally describe it.
It's gray, bright yellow hair. Yeah.
I think they also kind of serve as like a metaphor. Like, because it's on these like dark web and just kind of like chat rooms in general, we're hiding behind like alter egos and these like names that aren't our fictitious names. So the characters in real life are kind of embodying that by continuing to hide.
Yeah, that is something that it did make me think of, is like avatars and forums. And it draws a contrast between a movie you compared it to earlier, which is Funny Games, where the people are very much just like look like ordinary people rather than looking like done up to be intimidating.
Yeah. And also like not like having supernatural abilities like Jason or Freddy or stuff like that, like just humans. And the way I kind of looked at like the alpha character and stuff was essentially like characters who were in over their heads, so to speak. Like it's the transition from like talking about doing something to actually like going and doing it. Cause if like when you're watching it, they come off kind of scattered and not like an efficient, like killing unit. Like they're not like Navy SEALs or anything. They're just a bunch of like dark web chat room dudes who are trying to enact this thing.
Yeah.
That was a thing I was trying to really embody and not making them like technically proficient and stuff.
Yeah. I think that came through. One thing that I found a little curious, especially since these folks are sort of intended as a metaphor for folks who have in real life shot up places is that like there's a great deal of focus on a crossbow rather than like a gun. Is that just because guns don't make for a good horror movie weapon, or tell me a bit about that decision?
I suppose it was like a natural transition from something, you know, like my hope was that the film would start with the crossbow and you as an audience member would be like, oh, a crossbow, like obviously a mass killer with a crossbow. And then that slowly turns into a gun, and then that becomes a machine gun, and then it becomes, you know, I wanted there to be kind of this natural progression where the audience watches like their capacity for a destructive weapon being held by a villain grows to the point of where they're holding, you know, the most destructive thing you could have, I suppose would be how the film ends.
And like a big thing we talked about weapon wise was how like the slasher genre, you know, it always has kind of like the kitchen knife, like the big cake knife that the killer's going around stabbing people with. The new kind of like I think like modern thing that we're afraid of in the same capacity as the machine gun with all like the mass killings and stuff that are going on.
Sorry to be a little bit pedantic about this, but the thing you're calling a machine gun is the rifle that the
one that Alpha uses at the end.
Right. Okay. If you want to be pedantic about the specific technical meanings of different things, a machine gun is like a mounted piece of artillery, not like a thing you carry around in your arms.
So an assault rifle.
Yeah. They're okay. Assault rifle. It's interesting that, because I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. They do end up with that, but like for some reason the crossbow stuck with me a bunch more. I think it was the shot of the arrow through the leg. That one was like, oh.
You can get a crossbow for very, very cheap on Amazon. They're very that was how we got our prop.
I believe it. And it doesn't even need to work because you're not actually shooting anything.
No, it was very disabled. Yeah. With the weapons.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Did you use like actual weapons that had their firing pins removed, or are these purely completely props or?
It was airsoft guns, basically.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. It was safe. It was, yeah, we were very paranoid about blanks and whatnot. So it was airsoft guns and then CGI bullets and
okay.
I'm how it turned out.
Yeah. Cool. So you guys have been making these movies together for how long?
Around 10 years is we've met. Yeah, I think we met about 10 years ago. And so it started in college as short films, and then we've slowly transitioned into very, very low budget, hopefully getting higher budget independent films.
Okay. And so this is looking like sort of your breakout movie, fingers crossed.
What's it saying? Your mouth to God's ears.
I'm excited for what people think. Definitely, it'll be
cool. So how have you seen independent horror, like filmmaking like this, or even not necessarily horror, but independent filmmaking, change in that decade?
That's a good question. I would say, you know, we could obviously, I could say the generic thing of like it's gotten cheaper, but it's always getting cheaper. I mean, it's infinitesimally cheaper than it was 10 years ago, and I'm sure it'll be infinitesimally cheaper in 10 years. One of the things I've realized is to have a career in the entertainment industry or to pursue a career in the entertainment industry, you really have to like broadcast yourself and like be very big and like, I guess, vigilant about social media and making sure that your voice is always out there and you have an image that's out there.
Marketing is half the job for any job,
which is something that I think Zach and I have both come to terms with, and we're finally at least hopefully getting a groove on how to make that work and how to make that palatable for our audience and get what we need to them. I would say that is like with social media and the way it's kind of become more prolific over the past 10 years, I'd say that's the biggest difference, at least in my mind. Although I don't know if that's necessarily specific to film.
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily specific to film, but I do think that it's a useful thing for filmmakers to know about. Zach, I think you said something a while ago about, like, if there are any filmmakers listening to this. I do not have a huge audience by any stretch of the imagination, but they are disproportionately likely to be film industry professionals. I think that's cool. I'd rather make a niche product that a few people like than broad.
Yeah, that's rad. Yeah. And I mean, I think too, something Jimmy and I have always tried to do is, like, our goal at the end of the day is to, like, keep making movies. So we've always made movies around our constraints that allow us to make movies. Does that make sense? So, like, we haven't been writing scripts that are going to cost $80 million and need, like, to be on Mars and have all this stuff. It's always been tailored to, like, what do we have access to, like, right now that can keep us making movies. And
I bet you could make that desert look like Mars.
Yeah, we can make Mars pretty cheap.
Now we get it, like, green screen. But that's, like, most of our, like, a lot of times our conversations are like, what do we have access to? And then make, like, the creativity around that versus, like, dying on the hill of some really expensive idea.
Yeah, that's advice that I've heard a lot of times, and I think is definitely good advice for any aspiring low or micro budget filmmakers listening to this, is look at what cool things, like, you guys had this cool environment, and I'm guessing you guys, like, rented out the house for the shoot. So paying for one location, and the other one, I'm guessing, is just like a state park or something that you can just go film in, or
The woods, the earlier. Yeah, they were it's like open, like, just like government land. It's near, I grew up in Nevada. And so there's all sorts of just open. I don't know if it's called
BLM land.
Yeah, BLM land. Yeah, it's just which is Bureau of Land Management land, in case you're
doing this.
But it's essentially just open government land. And that's actually where I learned how to make movies, because I used to just go out there when I was really young. And just, it's great because you get ultra wide epic shots for nothing because there's nobody out there.
Yeah, that's great stuff. That's you're allowed to just go camp on BLM land. So yeah. I've done that a few times to save a few bucks instead of paying for a campground. Awesome. So fingers crossed, this is going to launch the next stage of your careers. Are you going to try to still stay, like, independent in terms of, like, looking for individual producers or executive producers who will fund another project, or are you aiming to get jobs somewhere?
I think we definitely want to keep making our own projects. We definitely kind of want to transcend into the next, like, realm of that, just, like, a little bit higher budget and more room to, like, do stuff, you know, because the lesser money, it's a more painful process, so I'm sure. Low budget filmmaker can share.
The tricky part then is getting more money while maintaining control. Awesome. Well, I definitely wish you luck with that. So going forward, not just for you guys, but in general, where do you see independent filmmaking going in the next few years?
I think as it always has, it'll continue to get cheaper. I've had this weird feeling for years, ever since I saw the movie. You ever see Unsane with Steven Soderbergh's movie? It came out probably 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, golly, that rings a bell. I've definitely heard of it. I'm not sure if I've seen it or not.
It's an excellent movie, and it's wild because he shot the entire thing on an iPhone 10 or iPhone whatever, and I've always thought that, you know, that could be, it just feels like the process is becoming so democratized to the point of where you can get very high quality footage for very, very, very easily, essentially. And so I imagine that will become some part of independent film in the future. I don't know if that'll be 5 years from now, but it's I've always just kind of had that in the back of my mind, as, you know, we go out with such a big camera and it's beautiful, but in reality your phone can get very high quality images.
What kind of camera did you use?
Oh, on this film, it was the Blackmagic Ursa Mini.
Blackmagic, you cut out a little. Blackmagic what?
The Ursa Mini.
Ursa Mini. Okay.
Yeah, it was our DP had chose it. And it was it's a great camera. I'm very happy with it.
I think too, like the big elephant in the room with the future of independent filmmaking and filmmaking in general is definitely got to be AI.
You're the first person to really bring that up.
I mean, you can't ignore it. I feel like no one wants to address it. The filmmaking community can cancel me, but it's there. If you see these like Sora videos that are coming out and stuff like that, it's something that's going to be prevalent, especially like not even 10 years, 5 years, 2 years, 1 year. The way we've been kind of looking at it with our creative conversations is like in the beginning, at least like this might be a way where we can like visually enhance budgets without the cost in terms of like VFX capabilities and maybe being able to like write things that are a bit beyond where we would normally think we could go, like battle scenes and stuff like that, adding people backgrounds. I think it's something that any filmmaker at this stage needs to be looking at and thinking about and not just like ignoring.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. That's not a perspective that I've heard people say out loud much, but I think it is probably a perspective a lot of people are thinking about. I haven't seen anyone do anything narratively interesting with AI yet, but that's because the capabilities of doing so only started existing like a week and a half ago.
Yeah.
By the time this comes out in another week and a half, who the hell knows what it's going to be able to do?
I will make Fallout 3.
Yeah, like every night I'm like sending Jimmy like Instagram videos that I see of like what Sora's created. It's just watching this thing grow is pretty nuts. I'm just sure like when they're making silent films, people were talking like, oh, someone's working on sound. And then same thing with color. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting question of like, I know I don't actually know a lot about how acting changed when transitioning from black and white to color, or if it really did. But I know that acting changed quite a bit when transitioning from sound to, or from silent to sound, because you started getting a lot more sort of realistic and subtle performances, less stage theater. Like, I'm curious, do you think what sort of changes, what sort of like, do you have any specific predictions in terms of how AI will change the way people tell stories?
What I've noticed is because we've been talking about making like a gladiator style film, or just like a swords and sandals type thing. And so we've been watching a lot of movies recently, and my mind thinks that if you're watching a scene and a characters are walking in the foreground and in the background there's a castle, like in Braveheart, that's a real castle. But my imagination is that with AI, you'll be able to make that and it'll become almost like a keystroke. Like you'll just say like, okay, we have this footage of these actors walking down the hill, let's draw a castle, and there's a castle. I don't think it'll affect like actual performances, at least at first. I think it'll mostly be stuff in the, it'll essentially replace matte paintings or do what green screens have done, at least in my opinion.
Okay, so you don't see like the next Thanos completely CGI character coming out of that?
Oh, I mean that's definitely a possibility. I was just thinking about like fully recreating a human being, but who knows? And the next Thanos could be AI. I guess I hadn't thought of that.
My stance is like everything's on the table in terms of like what it's gonna produce in terms of film. Again, like just for us, what I try to look at is, anything we could do with it to keep our careers alive, so to speak. Like if it can help us like grow as filmmakers until it replaces us entirely.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing that since we're delving into hot topics, there's one that I haven't really explicitly brought up, but I think about a lot, which is the sort of competing forces, competing needs of, on the one hand, people who make movies professionally as their sole source of income, needing to make enough money that they can do that, versus on the other hand, the ease and cheapness of creating these micro budget films, where I interview people who do this full time, and I also interview people who do this as like a side hustle, and I also interview people who do this as a hobby. And so it's really curious to me. You said, like, until they come and take your job. They could take your job in the sense of, like, you might not be able to make a living doing this, but they can't take your job in the sense of, like, somehow forcing you to not make movies anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's a weird, it's a weird philosophical question. I mean, I see what you're saying. As an artist, it's hard to wrap your mind around it because, you know, these skills that were valuable for hundreds of years are kind of no longer valuable, I guess would be the way to put it. It's just like, if a machine can do it, then they don't, then the human's not needed to do it. My theory on it has always been, like, I don't think a computer can be inherently controversial. Like, I've always thought that an inherent sense of controversy, which a lot of, like, popular art has had before it becomes popular art, is it's controversial. And I've always thought that is the human element, if that makes sense. But that's kind of a wide philosophical idea.
I recommend you look up the chat bot called Tay, T-A-Y, that was created by Microsoft like 5 or 10 years ago or something, because it learned how to talk from Twitter and it, like, turned into a Nazi, like, right away.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's kind of like this philosophical void that a lot of people are staring into, not just in film. Like, if you're an accountant or a lawyer and you're seeing this thing that can do accounting and like, you know, reference legal things, I think it's just kind of like a across the board just thing that our generation is staring into and future generations.
Could AI make this?
Yeah, that's right.
Holds up the mask again.
Folks at home, you can't see the mask. Yeah, just
Jimmy's in a constant war with AI.
Can an AI make this? And then just a blank sound.
Jimmy's been smashing computers with his hammer. So
yeah, it really comes down, I suppose, to the question of, is this going to be more like the invention of the tractor, where there are just now a lot fewer people who work in agriculture? Or is it more like the invention of the car, where, like, sure, there aren't people professionally driving horses nearly as much as they used to, but now they professionally drive cars instead? Oh man, deep questions.
Yeah, slippery slope.
All right, yeah, I'm definitely, man, now that you've, you know, uncorked the genie of asking people about AI, I feel like I'm gonna start being,
I'm definitely going down for this interview. I mislabeled guns, and then I brought up AI. This is the end of my career.
Yeah. This is the end of the trail for us together.
But I'm Alpha Wolf, so I have to be controversial.
Yeah, man, you're talking about doing that social media marketing and stuff. Make an in-character Twitter account and just be a jerk all day. There you go.
Do it, Zach.
All right, so followers, streaming exclusively on Screambox. I managed to accidentally portmanteau three words. Yes. Followers streaming exclusively on Screambox as of a few days ago, March 12th, 2024, and follower available on Tubi. Is there anywhere else you would like to direct anyone who's listening to this? You mentioned your social media stuff.
Oh, sure. Yes, of course. So we're officially Smaller Town Productions. We have an Instagram account. It's just Smaller Town. It's where we have a bunch of interesting pictures of the two of us and other stuff about our films. I'm on Instagram as I'm Rich. I have a bunch of H's. My face, or my profile picture on Instagram, is me wearing the mask. So you should see it. And then Zach, you're on Instagram as, what's your Instagram again?
Zach.
first act.
Just my last name, first name. As we said, we're new at this social media thing. We're reluctant. Yeah, no.
Oh man, no, I hear you. I hate marketing. It's my least favorite part of any project. if only it was possible to hire people who are actually good at it. But every time I've ever tried to do that, they weren't actually good at it.
Yeah, it's this weird thing.
It's a great struggle.
Yeah.
I was a marketing major too.
What did you learn?
I don't know.
You just learned that people don't actually know what they're doing and it's all luck. Or...
Yeah.
All right.
I think my one major takeaway from that was when you're in grocery stores, when you walk by the bread aisle, when you smell bread, it's actually like a scent that they're pumping into the air vent.
Ah,
because that bread's not being baked. It's a marketing thing.
Yeah. So,
interesting.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. Write that down.
trying to trick you. So Followers got picked up at the Chattanooga Film Festival by Cineverse, and Cineverse is not like a huge media company like Warner Brothers or Disney or whatever, but they are a media company that has multiple different like outlets. Like they own Screambox and they own Bloody Disgusting and a few other things. So how was, you know, being in that whole ecosystem worked out?
And they're behind the Terrifier franchise too, which is cool to work with the people behind that.
Yeah, but by behind you mean like they picked it up?
The right? Distribution company.
Yeah.
So far it's, I mean, like, I think like any independent filmmaker working with distribution companies, it's definitely like a big scary thing that we're all looking at. And we've all heard plenty of horror stories and things like that. And so far our experience with Cineverse has been really awesome. They've been like a cool team to work with. Their marketing team has been putting a lot of effort in getting us out there, getting us on podcasts and sharing social media stuff with us. And so like our really big goal with this movie was getting a distributor that would be a collaborator, not just this kind of like blank entity that puts the film out. And so we've had a really human experience with them up to this point.
Yeah. Yeah, so full disclosure, not that I really think it's like something that needs disclosing or whatever, but like I find people to interview through a combination of like just stumbling upon movies and being like, oh man, I really want to talk to whoever made this, and like people reaching out to me and being like, hey, check out my movie. If you like it, let's talk about it.
I thought my mom paid you.
Oh no, man, I'm not getting paid for any of this. No man, I'm doing it for the love of the art. Folks at Screambox reached out to me and were like, hey, we got this new movie, check it out. And so I watched it and I was like, oh cool, yeah, I want to talk to those people. So they're definitely like actively promoting your stuff, which I remember was something that you said you wanted, that you were looking for in a partnership with a distributor, and that's why you're not doing an aggregator sort of thing. So was there anything that was like really surprising about that sort of experience, like that you didn't expect about working with a distributor like that?
Getting announced on Bloody Disgusting was very, very cool and very, very surprising. I mean, they mentioned to us that they had an association with that publication, but just to have, you know, the photo of me and Revel, who plays Heather in the film. That was me in the mask, obviously. And just having that on Bloody Disgusting with them saying, comparing it to your next, that was very surprising. I mean, that felt really, really cool and really, really good. I mean, I felt like we had made a really good good association with Cineverse and with Screenbox.
Yeah,
that's great. Your next was a big influence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes me really happy. As like filmmakers, we put a ton of effort and blood, sweat, and tears into making these things, and it's just really nice to be met with a distribution company that cares about the product and is trying to help get it seen.
Yeah, that's great. I Yeah, it's good to see people still like putting effort and resources into this sort of thing, especially when I see so many other filmmaker things. I see so many other filmmakers having rocky relationships in the past few months with their production and distribution companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in the independent world, that's definitely like the number one horror story you kind of hear post-release is people dealing with distributors.
Yeah. That's why I think so many of the people that I've talked to have gone with an aggregator like FilmHub, which I had never heard of before I started interviewing people, and I have never worked with, so I can't vouch for them personally. But like, so many of the people that I've interviewed have done that, and then of course had to do all of their own marketing, which is a huge amount of work, and you are very much not guaranteed to be able to get on to Bloody Disgusting. So,
yeah,
that's great. I'm really happy that they're, you know, actually putting a push behind you guys and really trying to get the word out. That's awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. We're very happy, Ben.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me. And I wish you luck. I can't wait to, you know, see that in 6 months you guys have got the budget for your next movie.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you for having us. It's been awesome.